the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fandy Show. I'm Sean, and today on Signal Boost, we have Ashley Blackwell. Hello, Ashley.
Hi.
So the reason you are here today is we're here to Signal Boost Graveyard Shift Sisters, which is a blog about horror from a black perspective. I think I got the kind of basis of that, but you want to give a little more information about the project and your kind of take on it?
Yeah, it has multiple purposes. It's kind of a community building space for people who are interested in scholarship on black women in front and behind the camera in any sort of anything horror related. So, you know, if you're a horror comic book artist or a film actress, a filmmaker, a television actress, you know, a television showrunner, like, you know, specifically any black woman who has this invested interest in the horror genre. That's kind of what it is. And again, scholarship based, community based. And it's a lot of, you know, talking about news. I'm not going to ever compete with the hundreds of entertainment websites out there. So I'm going to focus on kind of the black women and women of color who maybe not get as much burn as they would on other major websites, and kind of talk about their work and what they're doing and interview them and things like that. So that's kind of what Graveyard Shift Sisters is.
Well, perfect. So I'm actually curious from your take, you know, because you focus on a very specific sort of community aspect of horror. What do you see as the sort of the position of black characters and figures within horror? Is it improved over the years? Have we moved past, I guess, the Scream set of rules in terms of horror, or where do you see it as moving in terms of horror and its in representation?
I think it's kind of all over the place. It's not, yeah, I can't say that, oh, everything is so different and everything has evolved since, you know, the 1930s. It really hasn't. It's kind of, I think, in every kind of decade or historical space where you've seen a plethora of black characters, and maybe even not so many in the horror genre, they kind of run the gamut and range. You know, they'll be the first victim, but there'll also be maybe the sidekick, or maybe that really the really rare thing is the one character that, you know, survives in the end and has a more centralized focus and has much more of a character background and story to them. So it's kind of, I cannot pinpoint and say, oh, everything's great and everything's new and everything's changed. Not really, because even in independent films, I still see the black character dying first, or I'm still seeing the character woefully underdeveloped opposed to the other white characters. So there's still a ways to go. But again, I think there's a lot of people who, you know, are putting a lot of effort into making black characters have some kind of meaningful story, and then the other ones not so much.
Okay, fair enough. I kind of figured that's where it was going to go. I figured horror is going to be like a lot of the other genres where maybe some small changes, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah.
This year, hopefully we've gotten some really interesting stuff to talk about for the years to come, because I've heard many good things about Get Out. So, out of curiosity, what led you into horror? Like, what drew your original interest?
I think just being a weird person in general and not feeling like I'm actually a human being. Like, I feel like I'm something else that was put on this planet. And so that kind of outsider status and that kind of those kinds of themes are really is the blood pumping in the veins of horror as a genre. There's a lot of films that deal with isolation and the fear of loneliness and the fear of being misunderstood and being a misfit. And a lot of the first films I watched as a kid were that was the the core of those films, like A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, Beetlejuice, you know, all, you know, these films really speak to me in those ways. And so it made me feel less alone, to be perfectly honest with you. And even as an adult, these are things I still struggle with. And I really love how the genre has really embraced the really silly and the really serious spectrum of those running themes. So that's why I really like it. And I've really latched onto it all of these years.
The second you mentioned Beetlejuice, it made me immediately think, wait a minute, I do like horror. Because I love that movie.
A lot of people, that's interesting that you say that, because a lot of people, I hear a lot of my friends who are into this like I am, not necessarily friends, but like colleagues, like acquaintances that I've been able to keep in touch with via social media. And they'll do interviews all the time, and they'll say that a lot too, because we run into a lot of people who are really apprehensive about horror. And they say, well, did you like Silence of the Lambs, or did you like Jaws? And like, you know, talking about all of these different films that are much more, not mainstream, but more like universal. The more people have seen them or heard of them, and like, yeah, I kind of like that movie. And we're kind of like, yeah, well, that's horror. Horror is this very, very broad, massively broad genre that has a lot of different subgenres running through it. And so that's kind of how we get people to kind of say, yeah, you probably don't like horror and TM, but you like some films probably.
Yeah, I think what I don't like about horror is what I sometimes refer to as like torture porn. It's the sort of obsession with gore and people getting maimed excessively. Like you mentioned Silence of the Lambs or like Beetlejuice, which is more comedy. Silence of the Lambs is being more thriller, psycho thriller, I guess would be another way. Those I find much more interesting. But that's, I think, because they're more interested in the human side of things than maybe like, let's just cut off limbs and like bathe ourselves in blood.
Yeah, that's what you will like about Get Out, because it's not gory. Yeah, a lot of people are turned off by gore, which is perfectly understandable. I tolerate it. I'm so used to seeing it nowadays, it doesn't really bother me. My first love of horror were actually slasher films. So, but more because of the character side to it. They, you know, there's character development and there's not character development, that could be argued. But like, you know, what I love about it is that, you know, I can get together with other horror fans and we kind of fill in the gaps about who these characters are and what they mean to us. So it's not all about just seeing someone get killed. It's really about how these characters survive and how they deal with the terror that they're immersed in, basically.
Well, that's interesting. So on some level, it's about really, as a community, kind of exploring the kind of inner dimensions of these characters and who they are. And as you say, like what it means to the people who love these characters, it's a traditional fandom in that respect.
Absolutely. I think that's why horror conventions are so popular. And that's why, you know, for example, I personally waited 4 hours in line to meet Robert Englund, the man who plays Freddy Krueger, four hours. It's one of my favorite stories to tell. I waited out in 30 degree weather for like an hour. Then they took you to a room, waited in the room for maybe another hour, hour and a half. Then they take you to the other room where he's actually in, and you're kind of waiting in this like line, but you're actually sitting down in chairs. It was crazy. They had a whole setup, but basically the idea is you go to a convention and you meet these people and these actors and these who've meant so much to you over the years, who you've loved seeing on screen, and then you see them in real life and you get an autograph, maybe a picture, and it's a good feeling, I should say.
Is it a little strange to meet someone like Robert Englund and to realize he's like a normal dude?
Maybe because I've loved Freddy Krueger so much, so I've seen him and do a dozen interviews, and I got a feel of how he was. And then I would hear firsthand accounts from other fans who will say, oh yeah, he's the nicest person. Like literally, like part of the reason why I was in line for so long is because he's the kind of guy, he's a gabber. So he likes to talk to everyone that comes to his table. So he's like, oh, you have an interesting name, or oh, you have such pretty eyes, or oh, you know, tell me more about, like, especially if you bring him a collectible item that's Freddy Krueger related that he's never seen before, or that's really rare, he'll want to talk about it with you. Or if you get it, he's that guy. So, you know, a lot of us separate the men and the women from the monster or the character, because, you know, it's kind of a community where we're kind of talking like, oh, this guy's a dick, oh, this guy's really nice. So it's kind of like we're having these conversations with each other.
That's awesome. That's a great kind of way to have a good interaction with fans, I suppose, is to just be very, very much a talkative kind of person.
Yeah, just being yourself.
Yeah. So, okay. So one of the other things that you're doing at Graveyard Shift Sisters, which I found really interesting and which Jen, who's originally supposed to be here, had talked me up about, which is the Twitter hashtag Friday Night Horror, in which you are live tweeting while watching a presumably a horror film of some description or other, right, fitting into one of the sort of facets of it. And I'm curious, you know, how long have you been doing this, and what led you to want to be part of doing that that sort of live event?
Everyone loves this live tweet thing. It's really interesting to me. I don't think I ever would have really done it unless Jamie from Black Girl Nerds we have a good camaraderie together and a great professional working relationship with each other. And, you know, it was so random. And I remember, like, you know, pre-Friday Night Horror, it was basically, you know, I love the film anthology VHS 2. It's kind of extreme to an extent, but I feel like I had such a great time watching it the first time. And it's not for the faint of heart. It gets really gory. It gets really intense, but it's a good, like, horror movie. And so one night I was just like, hey, you just like, and I was just kind of like testing the waters. Hey, you want to watch this? Because I kind of like doing that to people. I'm kind of bad in that way where I like to show people like a palatable extreme horror film that I know you can probably handle, but if you can't, I want to see your reaction. Because I used to do that with, I used to work with high school kids and they loved horror movies, so I'm like, okay, we'll watch this movie, and like just find looking at their reactions of screaming and laughing and having fun was just it was such a joy for me. It was such a weird joy, but a joy nonetheless. So that's what that was my intentions with VHS too. And so we watched that and we had a really great time. And I was like, oh, this was kind of fun. Because usually a lot of us are usually watching these films alone or with a small group of people, especially me. So we kind of got the idea of like, you know, I think Jamie was kind of like, you should do this more often. And I was like, okay, well, let's test the waters and see how this started. So in December of 2013, I believe that we've been doing it once a month ever since. And the original idea was to kind of do older films, because like the idea of kind of Friday Night Horror is like, again, one of my personal childhood experiences was I would always try to find a horror movie to watch on Friday night. I didn't have to go to school the next day. And this is what I'd love to do. My mom didn't really care. We had VHS tapes of HBO burnt copies of, like, you know, all the Friday 13ths and all Hellraisers and all those films. So, you know, my mom didn't really care. She was really anti about, like, no sex. Like, don't watch anything with sex in it. But but I could watch, like, violence and horror and stuff like that. So watching horror movies on Friday night as a kid was really a treat for me. And so that was kind of the idea. But as the market of streaming films has gotten much smaller, there's not a lot to work with as far as what's streaming and what's accessible to most people. So I branched out into doing more recent films, which is just fine. And, you know, there have been some live tweets that have been really fun. And again, I love seeing the reactions of other people, especially the people who are seeing certain films for the first time and cracking jokes. And so that's pretty much what it is. Again, it's a very community-based event that's done on Twitter that's very popular.
It certainly sounds like a really fun way to sort of engage in a fandom by just getting basically anybody who wants to participate in on a giant Twitter festival of joy.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Another element of Graveyard Shift Sisters, you do have a kind of a section you call the Take Action section, which includes a number of things, including talking about doing screening series for Black horror films. But you also have something that I think is very interesting from my angle as a current academic, which is talking about lecture materials for classes that are going to be discussing horror to include more discussion of Black horror history. And you have a number of resources related to that. And I'm curious, have you had much luck in terms of talking with other academics or people who are teaching about horror and doing more inclusive sort of lectures and materials?
Yes, actually, I hope to do more in the future, because that's kind of my end game as far as career. Like, I want somebody to just give me a job at a university where I can just do this all day. That is That is what I'm working towards. It may not happen tomorrow. It may not happen 10 years from now, but it will happen. I've been able to talk to, you know, Dr. Kenitra Brooks from University of Texas at Austin. She's a professor there. I think she's got tenure now. I'm not sure. Don't hold me to that. But basically, we've been talking to each other because a lot of her scholarship is about Black women in horror. And so I'm going to be published in one of her volumes. She's putting out a volume with another editor. Basically, it's a Black Women in Horror Critical Frameworks volume that's going to be published. I don't know when. Probably, I would hope before 2019 so far. But so I was happy to contribute to that. Talking to other Amanda Jo Hobson from Indiana State University. She's been a great supporter of the platform, and I've been able to do a lecture series with her. It was kind of like a lunch and chat kind of a thing. I did a couple of academic conferences. I wish I could do more. Again, that costs money that I do not have. I am in peak starving artist mode. It's ridiculous. But those are really fun. I get to, you know, travel a little bit. I did do one in Philly. I am based in Philadelphia. So yeah, I do like doing those lectures. I am a terrible public speaker, but I want the practice because I want to get better at it.
You sound more eloquent than me in this podcast, so I think you're doing good.
I think I'm just in my comfort zone. I don't know.
Last thing, and this is basically selfishness on my part. If you could recommend a couple of films by Black writers or featuring Black characters or whatever combination they're in that you think are really good films that people should watch, what would you recommend?
I mean, yeah. So if I was to recommend to people in general, I would, again, not go the extremes and not go the terrible extremes, because then there's some really bad Black horror movies out there. But I would start with the basics. Let's do it historically. I mean, so what people can do before I really get into detail, what people can do is I wrote for comingsoon.net. It used to be Shock to Your Drop. They used to be the website. But basically, I was headed up to write a 10 essential Black horror films list. So on there, you'll find like this range of different horror movies. So if you go to comingsoon.net and search for 10 essential Black horror films, you'll find it. But basically, what's on that list is The Blood of Jesus. That's a movie from the 1940s. Just giving you historical context of what Black horror films looked like. Like, you know, one of the first Black horror films that you would see and kind of what the themes that they're working with. Also, what else is there? So, you know, again, it's not a great movie. It's a good movie, but it's not a good movie. It's Death by Temptation. So, you know, thinking about 90s horror. So Death by Temptation is a good one. Tales from the Hood is the perfect anthology. If you really want to think about like peak 90s horror, Tales from the Hood is a great one. Going back again, bringing this bridge in between, it's like your 70s blaxploitation horror. So I would say watch Blackula. Again, Ganja and Hess is not a movie for everyone because it's very avant-garde and artsy, but I think the more you watch it, I know the more I watch it, the more I have an appreciation for it. And if you really kind of think about it and unpack it, it's a brilliant film and it's really enlightening. What else? And yeah, those are the big ones. I mean, Scream Blackula Scream is great because everyone loves Pam Grier. So,
true.
If you want to look to more towards, you know, Black women in horror films, more contemporarily speaking, like you can look at Southern Gothic horror, which, you know, Beloved, I would argue, is a horror film because of the supernatural themes that it has running through it. And even some of the horrific images of slavery. I always emphasize the expansion of people's ideas of what horror is and what it can be. And I think that's why it's so awesome and important that Black people are a part of it, because we are really participants in expanding people's ideas of what horror is, because the person of color and Black experience, it can be very horrific in a lot of ways. And I think that's why Get Out is resonating with so many people, because it's really exposing the nuances of racism and how horrific that is for a Black person.
Yeah. Well, excellent. So perfect. So the website is graveyardshiftsisters.com. So folks can find the website there. We'll obviously put links to, I think, almost everything you have mentioned will be linked in the show notes. So I'll make sure and I'll hunt down the 10 essential black horror films on Coming Soon as well, so folks can check that out on our show notes for this episode. So thank you so much, Ashley, for coming on to talk to us about your website and, of course, horror films. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. And see.
Welcome to the Skimpy Fantasy Show. Today on Signal Boost, we have author and game designer Carrie Patel. Welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much, Paul, for having me. It's great to be here.
You are most notable for being a narrative game designer for Obsidian Entertainment, most recently a certain little game called Pillars of Eternity.
Yes, that one.
And did you work on the DLC that's coming out?
I did. I worked on the White March parts 1 and 2. Both parts of those are out, and it was a lot of fun to work on. You know, obviously the turnaround time for a DLC is much, you know, shorter and faster than it is for a full game. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of fun to take a lot of lessons that we'd learned as a team on the full game and to apply those and create sort of a more contained story that still, you know, connected back to the larger narrative, but that did its own things as well.
How is doing a DLC different than doing an entire game as far as how do you approach? I mean, the turnaround time's a lot faster, but how do you approach adding on to something you've already built?
I think it's nice because you've got a lot of, knowledge as a team. You know, you've got your, you know, all the architecture of your game engine and all of the tools that you use. And, you know, I guess I should mention as well that, like, now that we are working on Deadfire, the sequel, that stuff is all very helpful to have as well. So, you know, you can hit the ground running. You can iterate a bit faster. You're not, you know, the stuff that you start to build and iterate in level, you don't have that problem that you often have, you know, early in the development process where you're like, well, we're sort of putting these things in, but half of this doesn't really work. So it's hard to sort of see how it plays. We've just kind of got to put in what we can and look at it later. Which is always a little bit messy because, you know, seeing your content in game, playing through it, is essential to, an essential part of the process. And when you're working on a DLC and you've already got all those things working, you can obviously do that much more easily. So I think it's just, it's a bit tidier. It's a lot faster. Both in terms of what you know as a team about how you work, how you design content, what kind of content you want to design for this game. You know, you've already established what the game is, and, you know, a lot of even production is about sort of finding the flavor and, you know, sort of whittling down, like, well, these are the things we're doing with this game, not those things. And you obviously, you know, you try to define that stuff in paper design as best you can. But a lot of times, it's the process of making the game that really helps you say, okay, well, yes, we've said it's this, but what does that look like? What does that look like in game? What kinds of monsters, what kinds of quests, what's the pace of combat? And, you know, again, when you've got the DLC, you already know a lot of that stuff. And obviously the scope of what you're building is not quite as big. So you can say, well, we're using this setting. We're going to tell a story about it. Here's our story. And, you know, we've got a lot of these other fundamental questions already answered, which is really helpful.
Nice. And you mentioned you're working on the sequel now. So what's that like?
It's really, really exciting. I'm afraid I can't say all that much about it yet. We did fund this one. As well, not through Kickstarter this time, but through Fig, which is a different platform. And we were just amazed and, thrilled at the response that we got, from the backers and the investors. We actually, got more investment for Deadfire than we did for the original Pillars of Eternity, which was really exciting. And, you know, again, like having made the first game, I think we're better able, you know, we know what we're able to do. And, you know, we've done some we're using an upgraded version of Unity, and you know, just there are a lot of great upgrades to our tools and our processes in general, and so we're able to do a lot of things that, you know, we weren't able to do the first time around, and we're able to polish a lot of the things that we did do the first time around more now. So, you know, again, we're starting as, you know, mostly the same team. So we've still got a lot of that, you know, a lot of that learning behind us. We've got a good foundation under us. And so, you know, it's been fun to be able to move forward with all that stuff already established.
Nice. I won't ask you for a time frame because I know computer games have very weird and wonky frames for actually getting stuff out. But I am excited there will be a sequel to Pillars of Eternity. So speaking of sequels, you have the third book in your series that has just come out, The Song of the Dead. The third in the, you call it the Recoleta trilogy?
I do, yes. So yeah, that does mean it's the last one. Yeah, no, I realize calling it a trilogy means, okay, it's a trilogy, this is number three.
I mean, unless you're Douglas Adams, you can't get away with having a fourth book in a trilogy. It just does not work.
Yeah, I mean, technically, trilogy isn't printed anywhere on the books themselves, I don't think. So, I mean, you know, there's nothing that stops it from becoming a four-book series. But yeah, I think at least for the time being, this is going to be the last one in this story about this world. And I'm very happy with it, and I hope that readers find a lot of closure for the characters and closure for the story of Recoleta and actually the world that it all takes place in.
So why don't we dive into a little bit of what this book is about and what readers can expect. Why don't you tell listeners who haven't read the first two books in this series a little bit about them and what we, and then we go forward into talking about this third book a little bit.
Sure. So the first book in the series is called The Buried Life, and it is a murder mystery set in an underground city where the study of history is forbidden. So basically it begins with the murder of a historian, and the inspector Malone, who begins looking into it, finds herself blocked by all sorts of red tape, and finds herself caught up in the middle of what appears to be a conspiracy involving a lot of the elites of her city. And Jane Lynn is a laundress who works for a lot of those people, and she becomes a witness to another crime and then, you know, worries that she may be a target as well because of what she's seen. And so the two of them are trying to solve this mystery, obviously, but as they're doing that, they're also discovering a much larger secret that's being kept from the entire city about sort of the world beyond. And for, you know, a little bit more background, Recoleta is an underground city, and in, you know, the setting that it takes place in, this is very common. There are these sort of very isolated city-states, they're very insular, and, you know, it's not that people don't go onto the surface anymore, you know, it's not a super dangerous place, it's just, it's not the done thing because they've lived this way for so long, and so, you know, of course the question is why? And what does that mean? And that's something that gets explored and finally answered in a lot more detail in The Song of the Dead. And then Cities and Thrones, which is the second book in the series, takes Jane to, a neighboring city called Medina, and, follows Malone, in the midst of some significant political upheaval, in Recoleta that comes at the end of the Buried Life. And so it's sort of about the two of them navigating this situation that is becoming both bigger and more complex than anyone really expected. You know, the events set off at the end of The Buried Life have a sort of chain reaction. You know, they're not resolved as simply as, you know, the people who set them in motion would like to think. And they have consequences for other cities as well. And so Cities and Thrones is very much about these characters navigating those situations. And then, of course, in The Song of the Dead, everything's come to a head, there. And, you know, in this sort of, there's been a process of opening the world up more and more in each book and, delving a little bit deeper into what's been going on at the periphery and sort of what made the world this way. And so The Song of the Dead is very much about the characters finally coming to understand what that is, what this, you know, awful history they have is, other civilizations that may have survived it differently and may have a very different story about it, and then how they can forge a productive path forward, and if that's even possible. So, you know, as a writer, one of the things that I thought was very interesting about and had a lot of fun with in writing The Song of the Dead was just playing with this idea of how important narrative is and how the way we frame our experiences and the stories we tell ourselves about the things that have happened, how that also really shapes how we move forward. And seeing these very different worldviews come into conflict, and, you know, trying to figure out, well, how can characters who look at this situation so differently, how can civilizations who look at this history so differently, how can they ever come to terms with one another? And that's sort of the big question.
Excellent. This sounds really exciting. I like how the world has been in the first two books. So you're expanding out the world more, because I've been trying to figure out how your world works, because world building is one of those things I'm really interested in, as you know. So I was curious. So looks like I'm going to get some more detail into what this world really is actually doing. I've had some ideas running, reading through the first two books, and I guess you're going to feed this reader as it turns out.
Yes, I certainly hope you're satisfied with what you get. But yeah, I wanted to finally open things up, finally explain them, and do it in a way that felt organic, not just, you know, and now you've gotten to the third book, so here's the info dump, but more like, there's been a conflict that's been sort of shown in different angles and different lights, you know, all throughout the series. And at first it was just about how this one city, Recoleta, dealt with its own history. And then it was about how these, you know, two cities sort of, well, more than two really, but how this coalition of cities in the second book, how they kind of negotiate this, this struggle for power and this idea of sort of, you know, what their roles are in, you know, in the civilization that has survived. And then, you know, again, and then book three, it's, you know, taking that to a much larger stage. Okay, well, again, a similar question, but we still haven't really answered it in its entirety. And, you know, it's time to do that now. So, you know, I think doing that world building over three books and building that out over three books, I feel like that one thing that made that work is that it does let you have that slow escalation. You know, cause like if you just start out at the end of the first book and, you know, you drop a big bomb, it's like, well, all right, but who cares? Because I don't know this world well enough and I don't know these people well enough. And, you know, you would have to move so fast to get to the point where that's even, you know, where it's reasonable to bring these things up, where they're relevant. And so it's been nice to be able to take a more gradual pace and to sort of let these things open up, through the characters' experiences, rather than through some idea that, like, well, I'm the author and my job is to teach you about the world, and so here's your info dump.
Yeah, so as far as theme goes, I mean, for the first book, I felt it was more like mystery and intrigue and machinations. The second book felt to me almost like contrasts in political maneuverings and revolution and the consequences of revolution. So what's the third book's theme?
I think it's really about journeys. Both Malone and Jane undertake sort of these parallel journeys, one in pursuit of the other and the other sort of in pursuit of this more distant goal to this, you know, farther off civilization. And, you know, it's obviously about, you know, these characters who have lived in this one city their entire lives around other people who have lived in this one city their entire lives, experiencing a wider world and coming to question the things that they thought they knew about it and, you know, trying to encourage other people to ask themselves those same questions. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's a physical journey, obviously, but it's also sort of a psychological and emotional one as well, as these characters come to discover, you know, new parts of themselves, also new truths and ideas about the world and why things are the way they are and, you know, who their friends and companions are. One thing I'd wanted to do, ever since writing the outline to the second book was to bring Jane and Malone into conflict in such a way that would make them antagonists toward one another. And I think the journeys that they've undertaken in the first two books are different enough, and the perspectives that they have at the end of that second book are different enough that it became very easy to see why, well, it's not just that they want different things, but they also see the way events have unfolded in very different ways and from very different vantage points. And so it was a lot of fun that part of that journey for both of them could be about sort of exploring this antagonism as two people, you know, approaching an issue from opposite sides. And then also asking, like, okay, well, is there a way to come back from that? And is it possible, you know, for you two to find, you know, a midpoint somewhere where you can meet in all this?
So it almost sounds like, in a way, that you were discovering their journeys in the writing of this trilogy as much, more than just planning out. It was like it kind of organically came out ahead of you, as almost as you were discovering it and reporting it to us, rather than sitting down at the beginning, like, this is where they're going to be at the end of book three. Is that fair to say?
I think it probably is. You know, I used to think I was a pure plotter, and I sometimes sort of wish I could be, because I feel like so much of my anxiety and frustration as a writer would diminish if I just had a really clear roadmap at all times of where I was going. But I think it's, you know, at Gen Con last year, I heard Brad Bollier give a few talks on sort of what he called the inchworm writing process, which is this idea that, you know, you plot for a while, but there comes a point when you just have to write to figure out the rest. And then you hit a point where you realize you're not sure where it's going next, so you take another break and you plot some more. And you just kind of inchworm your way along with, you know, with this process of, you know, outlining, then getting into the writing, and then stepping back again and trying to chart your way forward again. But that you do have sort of these big ideas about overall where you're headed. You know, it's just, it's the particulars of that journey, and, you know, maybe, and I think that even includes sort of the emotional, experiential, psychological component of it is something that you figure out as you're writing. I think that's a very hard thing to plot out. So yeah, it's a bit of both, but yeah, I think definitely a lot of it was figured out on the page.
Well, I look forward to reading, and I hope our readers will, listeners will, pick up the first two books if they haven't already, and pick up this one. It's out from Angry Robot Books, that's correct?
That's correct.
In good bookstores, virtual and physical, everywhere. So I want to thank you very much, Carrie, for taking your time to tell us about your book.
And thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.